Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number. To a good life's sleep.
Welcome to Creepy Shit Podcast. I'm your host, Star. Every week, we're digging into real hauntings, paranormal encounters that'll make your skin crawl, and true crime cases that prove reality is way scarier than fiction. This is where we sit down, like the creepy weirdos we are, and unpack the darkest, most disturbing stories out there. And here's the thing. We're probably going to use some sarcasm and humor to get through some of this heavy stuff, because if we don't laugh, we'll definitely cry. So settle in and let's get to it, because sometimes the creepiest shit is also the truest. This is Creepy Shit Podcast. I didn't really think that I'd go the whole Halloween week without some sort of bonus episodes, did you? Of course not. Hey, you guys, thank you so much for being here. We have got a very fun, spooky episode for you today with some guests in the studio. There's actually really not much for me to say on this because we're going to get right down to it real quick, and I'm going to drop this in and you guys are going to love it. So go grab your favorite bevy, cozy up, and let's do this. Hey, everybody. What is up? Welcome back to another unhinged episode of Creepy Shit. I am, of course, your host, Star, and holy hell, do we have some dark tales for you today? We are diving in to some really creepy people in history, including the blood-soaked legend of Elizabeth Bathory, the blood countess herself. But first, I've got to tell you guys, I've got some special, incredible guests here in the studio with me today, and I am so stoked. Welcome, Something Strange. Hey, ladies, how's it going?
Hello.
Hello.
We're very excited to see you and be here.
Yes, I am so excited to have you here. Like, oh my gosh, when we got together, truth be told, ladies and gentlemen, we did another episode together on their podcast, which you should definitely go check out. After you're done listening to this one, you know, when you play next in your queue, just go ahead and hit that. You'll be good to go.
And it is out. It's been out.
Yeah. So I'm super stoked. We're going to talk about people today. And just to get everybody kind of familiar with you guys and Something Strange, how did you guys like come to be Something Strange, and how did it all take place for you guys?
Do you want to go? Sure, I can dive in here. So we actually started with a different podcast about a TV show that we both really liked. It's on Amazon Prime called Good Omens. And that was our first.
Yeah.
I just started watching that.
Oh, you're in for a time. You're in for a time.
Seriously, David Tennant for life. Okay.
Oh, definitely.
Everything like.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So we loved that show, and we did kind of a recap podcast about it called Sauntering Vaguely Podwards. And we're no longer doing that podcast due to some circumstances outside of our control. But when we were working on that, we knew, okay, this show is finite. Like, it's not going to go on forever and ever. We knew there were going to be a maximum of, originally we weren't sure how many seasons there were going to be. It was only supposed to be two with the potential of a third. So we were looking for ways to expand and keep doing this because we really enjoyed it. And one of the things that we did for Sauntering Vaguely Podwards were these little bonus recap episodes called Aziraphale's Extra Research, where we would kind of do little deep dives into topics that came up in the show. So we just put one out that on our podcast now that was a remastering of one of those Aziraphale's Extra Research about the Garden of Eden. And we have some other ones that we did as well. But we, Bree, this was actually your idea, I think. She looked at that and was like, why don't we kind of keep doing that just in its own format versus being related to a show or a movie or whatever? Why don't we just keep, because we both like weird history, we both like spooky stuff. And I said, yeah, let's do that. So that's where we're at now.
Yeah, we just kind of transitioned a little bit more to the like spooky and even a little bit true crime-ish area, which I think true crime is more Christiana's jam and the spooky paranormal is more of my jam personally.
Yeah, that's right. Fair.
I can so relate to that. I am slowly like trying really hard to kind of ease my way into like some of that. Like more true crime, I'm with you, Brie. I love having like all the spooky things. Like I want castles, I want cemeteries, I want, you know, all the things, you know, haunted mansions and all the things. But very cool. So tell me, what do you ladies have prepared for some of your creepy people in history for today?
So I think we both chose I almost said individuals. Every person's an individual.
Right.
Sorry. I haven't had enough caffeine, apparently. We both chose a person, and we joke we sometimes share a brain cell.
Yes.
Because we did unintentionally both choose authors.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah.
So I chose Sir Arthur Conan Doyle because of all of the spiritualist stuff connected to that. Which I just said, I don't do a lot of true crime. And who did I choose? The author of Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And then I chose the author Agatha Christie, the master of mystery, because she had a period in her life where she disappeared. And when she was found, spoiler alert, she couldn't tell anyone what happened. She didn't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She didn't know. Yeah. I'll get into it in my segment, but she had a moment in time where no one knows what happened in that time. Whether she wouldn't tell anyone or couldn't tell anyone is, we'll talk about that. But
that's
weirdness.
Seriously, you just made my hair stand on end.
Yeah.
That. Like,
yeah.
People who lose track of time like that are so, they're like this. I don't know. They're like a majestic, spooky unicorn, like, you know,
so, truly.
Right. On. So. OK, so who wants to go first?
Don't me to.
I mean, I can go first just that way.
That's fine.
You know, it's the anticipation. I'm the.
Yeah.
When I would have to like audition for counties and stuff, I'd be like, I will go first. That way I don't have to sit here and think
about it. Right.
Think about it. And then like get into that like thing of like, how am I going to follow that up? Like,
yeah. Yes.
Like now I need to go back to the drawing board and just start all over because everything I have is awful.
Oh.
I go through that all the time. Like, no joke. And yeah. Yes, I'm not saying that yours is awful by any means.
Oh, you're good.
But... imposter syndrome. We all have it.
Yes.
Yes. So, all right, cool. Let's go with it. I love it. Go ahead. Kick us off, Bree.
Awesome. Well, we'll get this train rolling. So I'm curious, what do all of you guys... I thought you were going to sneeze. Sorry. What do all of you guys know about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle? What info do we have going into this?
I think the only thing I do know is about the Sherlock Holmes thing. I really don't know that much about him as an author. Or like his life in general, I should say, because I do love Sherlock Holmes, like without a doubt, like love the show, love the movies, love it all, love the books, all of it.
I am pretty close to the same thing. I know he is obviously the author of Sherlock Holmes, and which is the extremely, extremely popular detective series, popular to this day. It's spawned a lot of modern day takes of Sherlock in movies, TV, etc. But I do know a little bit about him just from previous episodes that Brie and I have done. I know he was involved in the spiritualist movement.
Okay. I know what you're talking about now. I was like, what episode is she talking about? I don't remember this.
I know you kept looking at me and I was like, should I not say that? Should I?
I forgot about that episode. That's fun. That's fine. That's fine.
But I don't want to give, like, we didn't go too deep into that. But I know he was involved in spiritualism and occultism and in that realm when he was alive.
He was heavily involved.
Yes.
Such a sucker for a cult.
Right?
Never joined one. Like, I feel pretty confident that my mind is pretty solid enough that I can't be influenced that way. However, like, the stories behind cults always rope me in. Like,
yes.
Always.
I will say, do you watch, Brie, I know this won't necessarily mean anything to you. Do you watch the show Arcane, or have you heard of the show Arcane?
No.
It's on Netflix. It's great. I recommend it. But for those who have listened to Arcane, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say I joined Victor's cult.
Ah!
That's it.
Okay. In fun fact, I have to get back on Netflix because I really want to watch the new season of Wednesday.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, okay. And there's a few other like shows out there that I'm like, okay, while I'm doing that, I'll probably hang on to it for a little bit, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, so I
recommend, yes, I recommend adding Arcane to it. It's an animated series and it is beautiful. Like the artwork is astounding, genuinely astounding. And the soundtrack, 10 out of 10.
Hasn't Imagine Dragons.
Like downloading and giving Apple Music all my money.
Yes.
Hasn't Imagine Dragons done some stuff for Arcane?
They did. Okay. Yeah. They did the theme.
I love them too. They're so amazing.
Yes. You'll have to try it out and let us know what you think.
Like, joke, just a quick little side note before we dived into this further. You know how Stephanie Meyer felt like Muse was like the soundtrack to like the Twilight series?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very strongly that Imagine Dragons would be like the soundtrack to a book that I would write.
I like that. That's cool.
Okay, I digress. Okay.
I will say that I got to see, I only see certain bands live because I have chronic migraines. Imagine Dragons was one of the ones that I got to see. They were so good.
I believe it.
I've only seen them. I've seen Bastille twice and I've seen Fall Out Boy once.
Yeah. And Coldplay?
Oh, I did see Coldplay. I forgot about that. Okay. Yeah. Man, so little room in my brain.
No, that's okay.
All right. So, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So, like you guys said, he is a Scottish writer.
For some reason, I did not realize he was Scottish.
Unless Wikipedia is lying to me.
Oh, I believe you. I'm very excited about that fact. Anyway.
So, he is best known for creating the fictional detective Sherlock Holmes. He was born May 22nd of 1859 in Edinburgh, Scotland, and he died July 7th. That's very close to your birthday, but the wrong year.
It is.
1930 in Cowborough, Sussex, England. He had a heart attack several months earlier and passed away, I think, just
like complications.
Yeah, or just the stress on the body.
Yeah,
sure.
He was I'm going to switch. Yeah. I think that should say 12 children, but I'm not sure. He was born into a large Catholic family and received most of his education from Jesuits. However, by the time he enrolled at university, he was like, yeah, no, I'm not Catholic anymore. Sorry. And so he had rejected like Christianity and Catholicism by the time he got to university.
Okay.
So he received his Bachelor of Medicine and Master of Surgery qualifications from the University of Edinburgh in 1881. And in 1885, he also received an MD. So not only was he like a very proficient author, he was like an actual medical doctor.
Wow. I didn't know that either.
I did not know that. That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
He had his hands in all kinds of things.
Good for him.
Right?
So
all trades.
He is a jack of all. There's even more. Don't worry. That is, he had a vast array of interests.
Cool.
So in 1885, he married Louisa Hawkins, and they had two children, Mary and Kingsley. Kingsley is important. He'll come back later. Unfortunately, Louisa did pass away in 1906, and then he married Jean Leckie in 1907, and they had three children, Dennis, Adrian, and Jean. So mom Jean and child Jean.
Oh.
So he was also involved in two wars and was an adventurer. So he's an author, a doctor, a war hero, and an adventurer.
Wow. Can we invite him? You know the game of like three people, living or dead, you would invite to dinner?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I want to invite him.
You know, we're already joking about being haunted by the ghost of Washington Irving. Let's just invite Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, too, and we can have a real party.
Oh, perfect.
Right? Let's throw him in there. Throw another log on the fire.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to hear about some of his adventures and war things?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
So he worked as a physician on several ships all over the world. So he was all over the place. He was a correspondent in Egypt, and he ran a hospital in South Africa during the Boer War. And then when World War...
Like, finding the time to do all this. Like,
I don't know. Then when World War I broke out in 1914, he helped organize a local volunteer force and worked as a war correspondent. Now, in the war, he had lost a son, a brother, and a nephew. So I believe it was Kingsley, who we mentioned earlier.
Oh.
And he lost a brother and a nephew.
Oh, my gosh.
So... The World Wars, right, especially the First World War, though, really renewed interest in spiritualism.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting into the spooky stuff now.
Okay, cool.
I think the same thing happened with the Civil War, correct? Not necessarily spiritualism, but it renewed interest in, like, the afterlife and, like, ghost-type things. Is that correct, Christiana?
Yeah, I believe we talked about that a little bit in the Marie Laveau episode. About that, because that was close to the time of the Civil War.
Yeah, because that would have been the increase in like the voodoo and hoodoo and
That's it.
So as we continue going into some of the spooky stuff, this surprised me as I was reading. Do you guys know what he was knighted for? Because my guess was completely wrong.
I would have no idea, but if you gave me a multiple choice, I'd be down.
Okay, let me think of some of these. All right, so A, adventuring, because A and adventuring have the same first letter. B was for his literary work, or C was for the medical services he provided during times of war.
Oh, I'm going to go with B.
I would think C. That's my first knee jerk, but I feel like that's probably wrong.
You're correct. I thought the same thing as Star. I thought it was for literary work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty incredible. He ran a hospital during the Boer War, and
let's see, did he run it or worked in a field hospital?
Yeah.
So he was knighted in 1902 for his work in a field hospital in South Africa, along with other services during the South African Boer War. He also had some kind of pamphlet that he wrote in support of this. But yeah, like I always thought that he was knighted because of his literary work, because that's what he's known for, not the fact that he was like in the hospital treating people during these wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What an amazing guy.
And he's best known for Sherlock Holmes, right? So we are going to get into that a little bit before we get into the spiritualist stuff, if you guys are cool with that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So Sherlock Holmes first appeared in A Study in Scarlet, which was a novel-length story published in Beeton's Christmas Annual in 1887. So the model for Sherlock Holmes actually came from the master of diagnostic deduction.
Hmm.
So the stuff that he learned in med school.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
Like when you say the model for Sherlock Holmes, you mean like how he solved,
yes,
like the fictional character solved crimes?
That is what I understand it as, yes.
Okay. Okay.
So like that came from his medical background.
Okay.
And he also felt compelled to kill off Holmes in The Final Problem because he was becoming so popular. He's like, I'm not going to be able to write anything else because everyone loves this character so much.
Yeah.
He wanted to work on other interests. And he also felt that Holmes overshadowed the merit and attention of other historical fictions that he had written. He also had a lot of nonfiction military writing. So like, he's known for Sherlock Holmes, but that is not the only thing he did.
Was the military writing like memoirs or of his time in service or discussions of...
I'm not entirely sure. It was kind of, I think the source was talking about like his historical fictions and his military writing. So I don't know if they were like...
Kind of married a little bit to each other.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Who's ready for the spooky stuff now that we got background?
Yes. Yeah. Throw me into the deep end of the pool.
Exactly. Right. All right. So he was very, very into spiritualism. He viewed his work with spiritualism as one of the most important efforts in his life. So a lot of his literary efforts were very focused on spiritualism. I think later in his life, a lot of the proceeds even went to it. I'm saying spiritualism a lot. I feel like I'm quizzing everyone now that we started with that quiz. What do you guys, like, spiritualism's a whole big topic, right?
Right.
I know we've talked about it in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to?
Yeah, go for it.
So it's kind of the study of, I guess you could say, like, what comes after and spirit, studying the potential behind spirits of themselves could be involved with, like, talking to spirits, different ways to communicate with them. That kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a whole... Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, that's okay. I feel like spiritualism, like, my understanding too is always that it's like, the first thing that comes to my mind is like Ouija boards and pendulums and like that kind of thing. That's the first thing. It's in a way to have some sort of connection between our world and their world. That was always my understanding, but I don't know if that's actually legit, but that's like how I've always kind of interpreted it.
No, I think that's pretty much along the right vein. It was this movement that became really popular in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And that's where you get like the Ouija boards, the table tapping. The ectoplasmy stuff. So it was this, you know, after, especially with World War One and this great loss of life, as people wanted to make connections with their lost loved ones. So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle became one of the world's most well-renowned proponents of spiritualism. So this supposedly started after a seance where he believed his son Kingsley, who had passed away fighting in the war, had contacted him. My sources disagree on this, though. Another one said that this was false and his interest began about 30 years earlier. He actually joined the Society for Psychical Research in 1893. So like the seeds of the psychic research have been planted for years, but kind of the consensus I got and just my own thoughts from the material was that that seance might have been what brought it into growth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, can you imagine like you lose a child in this horrific war and then all of a sudden, oh, I might be able to talk to them again. Why wouldn't you pursue that?
Make sure they're okay.
As a mother,
yeah.
So now we're getting into another just really weird out of left field thing about his life. He had this like bromance and then eventual feud with Harry Houdini.
I forgot.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, I love hearing about Harry Houdini because like that's Appleton, Wisconsin is his hometown.
Right.
And, cool. That's where Harry Houdini came from. And so and there is the Houdini Museum and castle like right in downtown Appleton, and I'm always fascinated by him. I had no idea that there was a link there, so that is super cool. Please
I had forgotten about this. I listen to a lot of podcasts that are about like paranormal and weird stuff. Yep. And this has probably gotten brought up multiple times and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. So Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle were brought together by spiritualism in like around 1920. They had this bromance, but they had some very different approaches to spiritualism. Houdini was much more skeptical. I would have to double check this, but I think I remember hearing that he was kind of known for debunking mediums. But from what I understand, Houdini was really respectful about the differences between the two men. Like, he was like, yeah, I don't agree with you. You know, from my understanding, I don't think it wasn't that Houdini didn't believe in the afterlife. I think he was very skeptical of people who said they could contact people from the other. Like, he wanted actual proof. And there were a lot of people that were faking it at that time.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And what I think is so interesting, too, is, you know, here you have Harry Houdini, who doesn't agree with him, but at the same time, like, they're still pretty much okay friends, and they have an understanding and a respect. And it's like, wow, so, like, you really could get along back in the day if you didn't agree. It was okay. Like,
well, yeah, for a while.
Nowadays,
for a while.
Oh, you don't agree with me? Okay, we can't be friends. Like, yeah. You know.
For a while, things did get a little bit messy.
Yeah. Okay.
But they were able to maintain their differences for a while. There was one rupture that really kind of negatively affected their friendship.
Mm.
But I do see what you're saying, Star. It's like, hey, like, these people who have very different opposing views could talk to each other and could be like, okay, I respect what you're saying. I don't agree with you.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. So this rupture in their friendship began when Houdini joined the... joined Conan Doyle and his wife for a private seance where Conan Doyle's wife supposedly contacted Houdini's mother from beyond the grave. Like we said, Houdini believed in the afterlife, but this experience really upset him for several reasons. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife did not do her research. She did not understand the assignment. She did not. She did several sheets of automatic writing. Some of them had very Christian themes. Houdini was from a Jewish family. His okay. mother
this
was the
like
one.
AI research for like the 1800s.
Yeah. According to one of my sources, his mother was a rabbi's wife. So, like, oh, yeah. So that was a big. The other thing is she barely spoke any English.
Oh, wait.
So all the responses they were getting were in English, and they had very Christian themes. And I, from what I understand, he was very, very polite about this encounter, but was also very deeply upset by it, understandably.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I don't think he even mentioned it to them. But they apparently tried really hard to stay friends after that. But they were privately starting to argue a lot about the medium cases.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read too far into this, but eventually they started exchanging, and I quote, sharp letters in the New York Times.
Oh,
ooh. Making it public, no less.
Gosh.
It's like, you know, angry tweeting.
Yeah, yes. Right? Yes.
That classic used to go around on Facebook all the time, like, tag me next time.
So I used a PBS article, and this is a quote from it. While praising him as the greatest man in our generation, Conan Doyle condemned Houdini for being biased and publicity hungry. Houdini wrote that there is nothing that Sir Arthur will believe that surprises me. It had been one of the oddest pairings of the century.
Ooh.
Wow.
Dang.
It's like they're trying to polite fight, but there's some venom behind those words.
Yeah. Serious undertones of, and no pun intended, like a dig. You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. I feel like they needed to be put in a room together. No one else public, no publicity, no wives, just the two of them. And all right, argue it out.
Yep.
We're going to put the get along shirt on and then we're
right.
Be done.
Let's have someone mediate.
Yes.
Houdini was not the other person, not the only person Sir Arthur Conan Doyle faced opposition from. He, in 1920, he was in a debate with humanist Joseph McCabe, and he got criticism from other spiritualists due to a very, very famous fairy case, the Cottingley fairy photos. Are you guys familiar with those?
I've heard of them. I don't know much about them.
these little girls, and I am pulling this from my brain, so like hopefully this is factual. These little girls said they were seeing fairies out in the woods, so they got photographic proof.
Okay.
Which was put all over newspapers of like these you can still find, if you Google it, you can find the pictures. Now it was late, and spoiler alert, it was a hoax. They were taking like paper cutouts and like doing like, you know, the early 1900s version of Photoshop.
Very little kid.
That is too
like
cute.
Style.
But Sir Arthur Conan Doyle like was very much proponent of these not being a hoax, and so he kind of
lost some credibility.
Yeah, because like it was proven to be a hoax. It was like the girls even admitted it was a hoax, and he was this big proponent of like, no, they're telling the truth, which
even after they admitted it was a hoax? Or
I'm not sure. I know, okay. At least during this, before it was the actual admission, he was very much on their side. He was a steadfast spiritualist for the rest of his life. And then this nice little, I have like a nice little closing vignette kind of thing. After his passing, a seance was held on July 13th of 1930 at the Royal Albert Hall, in which mediums claimed to have contacted him from the beyond.
Oh, now seeing a bad, I believe, because if he was that into spiritualism, like absolutely he's going to want to be a part of it in his afterlife. And I think it would be easy to contact somebody that way if they wanted it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if he was already talking about that kind of stuff when he was alive, gosh, wouldn't that be an interesting book of like the people to contact in spiritualism?
Because
he's like Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know when, I'm not sure when Harry Houdini passed away, but I feel like his first words were, "Where is Harry?" And tell him I said, "Na na 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 na."
You mean Arthur? Oh, you mean Arthur Conan Doyle was saying that to Houdini?
Yes.
Didn't Houdini have a thing where like a message was supposed to be sent to his wife or vice versa when one of them died first, but like only...
Oh.
I'm not making that up, am I?
That's ticking something in my brain and I don't know, I can't remember why, but it's... I feel like that sounds vaguely familiar to me for some reason.
I really think it was that he wanted to prove that there was an afterlife, but he couldn't find credible people to prove it, where Arthur Conan Doyle was like, no, like he was just so invested in it that he was kind of more open to it than maybe Houdini was.
Sure.
But anyways, it's interesting that he's known for this like very analytical, very deduction style type writing with Sherlock Holmes, but then he was into all of this mysticism and into this, he was very, very into all of these beliefs. It's just such an interesting juxtaposition.
Yes. Great word.
I stole that from her because she said it in the last episode we recorded.
Nice.
Can I point something out that I just noticed between Harry and Arthur Conan Doyle in their views? I feel like they had skin in the game in very different ways and accidentally ended up hurting each other because of that particular skin they had in the game. Like Arthur Conan Doyle, like you said, he potentially lost a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was kind of, even if he was already kind of predisposed, shall we say, to being open to this kind of thing with like current, like joining the spiritualist movement and everything after World War II, after losing so many of his family member, or after World War II, World War I, losing so many of his family members, I can see him really feeling like, especially his child, like, I just want to talk to them again. And that was such a brutal war. The ways that people were dying in that war, wanting to make sure his family was okay, versus Harry Houdini, who was like, okay, I see this, I hear that, and I get where you're coming from, but I also need more solid proof. And then when Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife completely kind of botched, I guess you'll say.
Yeah.
The what would you call it? A reading?
Seance?
You know, he handled it very respectfully, but that would be incredibly, incredibly hurtful to him as well. So these two friends, you know, even though they were trying to really be respectful towards one another, ended up really hurting each other at the same time. Which, that's sad.
Yeah, it is. Disappointment. and the realizations of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Hopefully, I want to picture them reconciled.
Yes.
That makes me happy.
They somehow landed on like some neutral territory and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Someone in the afterlife sat them down and was like, all right, guys, all right. We're going to have a couples therapy between the two of you.
Right.
I just want to picture them friends again.
Yes, for sure. Because I can see, like, I see the appeal. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
All right. I love that. I love it so much.
There's my interpretation.
Awesome. Cool.
All right.
My turn.
Okay. Do you guys mind if I take a quick pause and just throw some chapstick on?
Oh, of course. Please.
Okay.
This time of year, I tell you what, it's like so necessary. And now I got to know, like, we're going to take a, this could be like our commercial break. So what's like, what's your favorite chapstick?
Oh. You're muted. There you go.
Thank you.
Are you? I
like Burt's Bees, I think. It's very, it feels like it lasts a long time, but I'm currently, what's in my purse? It's Blistex Satin right Nectar.
There's and it's that I love, and it's called Soft Lips.
Ooh.
And I'm like, perfect. That's exactly what I'm after. So cool. And like, that's the one.
This works perfectly for me.
Right. This is epic.
All right. Well, I am chapsticked up and ready to go here.
Sweet.
So my author, I said earlier, is Agatha Christie. And do you guys know much about her? Oh, sick.
There was a Doctor Who episode that she was in. It was the Wasp and the...
Wait a minute. You're right.
Yeah. It was with Tennant.
It was with Tennant.
That's not the girl in the fireplace, is it?
No, but that is the same. No, it's not the girl in the fireplace. That was with Madame Pompadour.
Yes.
Madame Pompadour.
Yeah.
That's a good episode, too.
Wasn't that David Tennant's girlfriend at the time?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. Right.
I'm not sure. I know there's an episode with her in it, though.
His wife?
Yeah.
That's his daughter, the doctor's daughter.
And I love that episode. I cried. It was the first Doctor Who episode I cried in. I was so upset.
I love the episode with him and Donna when they find the Ouds.
I love the Ouds.
Yes.
The Ouds and the hospital episode too, I really love. Where they're the cat people.
Oh, cat people is a great episode. That's a fun episode.
That's with Rose.
Oh, is that with Rose?
Yeah.
Oh,
the where the cat people are like experimenting on the humans to get rid of diseases.
Yes, yes. That is Rose. That is Rose.
Like the last human in existence, and she's just like a skin face.
Yeah, Cassandra.
Yes.
Moisturize me.
Oh my gosh, you do a really good impersonation.
You did great impersonations.
Thank you.
But the Agatha Christie one was with Donna.
Yes. That's my favorite companion. I love Donna. Catherine Tate is queen.
Yeah, it was an underrated companion.
Very underrated companion. I would strongly agree with that statement.
So is Rory from the 11th Doctor.
Oh, yeah. I haven't got there yet.
Sorry.
Nope.
Anyway.
Okay. But Dawn is underrated. I agree with that.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie. She was born Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller, which is a beautiful name. And she was a famous mystery author who lived in the early half of the 20th century. In her lifetime, she wrote 66 detective novels, as well as 14 short story collections. And her novels have only been outsold by Shakespeare and the Bible, which marks her as the best-selling novelist of all time.
Can we be haunted by her?
Yes. Okay. All right. Agatha Christie, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Washington Irving. Oh, that's a trio.
Oh my goodness. Those are all authors too.
Yes. What a trio.
Wild.
All right. So she was also an extremely accomplished playwright and wrote over 20 plays. She was the only woman to have three of her plays running at the same time in London's West End, which is a record that is still unbroken to this day. And her play, The Mousetrap, is also the longest running show in the world. Another unbroken record. So she is real cool.
Yes, she is. I love her already.
Yes. So she was born September 15th, 1890. And I'm going to directly quote the next sentence from the Agatha Christie website, because every turn it took was a left. It, quote, her father was a wealthy American man called Frederick Miller, and her mother was Clara, the Irish niece of Frederick's father's second wife.
Wow. Wow.
I was like, what?
Right, like, wait a minute. Huh?
The Irish niece of Frederick's father's second wife.
Did you ever see the movie Spaceballs? Did you ever see
that? Yes. Oh my gosh, Chris loves that movie.
I love my partner. And he's like, your father's brother's nephew's cousin. So what does that make us? Absolutely nothing.
Yes, correct. So Agatha was the youngest of three. Her older sister Madge was born 11 years before her, and her older brother Monty was born 10 years before her. Sadly, her father did pass away when she was only 11 years old. Agatha had a case of, what'd you say?
I said, oh, poor kiddo.
I know, it's sad. So Agatha had a very serious case of wanderlust, developing a love for travel when she was just a child that would follow her through adulthood. She accepted a marriage proposal in 1910, but eventually broke it when she met and fell in love with Archie Christie in 1912. She also participated in war work twice in her life. So this was weird as you were going through Arthur Conan Doyle. I didn't realize how much these two are interconnected in a way.
Oh, do you think they met? Okay.
Please hold.
Sorry.
No, you're okay. So the first time she experienced war work was in World War I. In Torquay, England, Agatha took a position as a nurse in the Voluntary Aid Detachment in a Red Cross hospital. Archie was an aviator, and he was actually deployed to France. And the couple did eventually wed on Christmas Eve, 1914, before Archie had to go back to France 3 days later. Thankfully, he did survive his deployment. And he was posted to the War Office in London in 1918. So moving on here, I'm trying to kind of do this quickly because I had a lot that I was trying to condense. And we know from my episodes, brevity is not my strong suit. So Agatha's first novel was written somewhere between 1915 and 1917. Somewhere between the years of 1915 and 17, I couldn't find the exact time. Madge, Agatha's sister, made a bet with her that Agatha wouldn't be able to write a good detective story. Agatha said, bet. While plotting this novel, she found inspiration from someone she saw on a tram. Her detective was inspired by a Belgian refugee that she met during her time doing war work. And the method of murder for her novel was also inspired by her war work. It drew on her expertise from the dispensary that she worked at, because she was trained in like dispensing medications. And she decided the method would be poison, which I think this is kind of like apothecary work type of deal, where she, you know, it wasn't just dispensing meds, but like it was knowing how the meds worked, that kind of thing.
That is helpful to know if you're going to poison someone, like how much can you give? Like,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Of what and what meds even like contradict one another, that kind of thing. So again, when you were talking about how Conan Doyle's war work inspired him, I was like, whoa, there's some like overlap here. We did not do that on purpose.
We just made sure we had different people. We didn't actually like
do any collaborating. Yeah.
Right on.
So the novel, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, was born through all this. It took 7 different tries for Agatha to get her novel published, but in 1919, the manuscript was accepted by John Lane of the Bodleyhead Publishing. I believe it's either Bodley or Bodley. I apologize. He also contracted Agatha to write 5 more novels. Wow. And then, yes, 1919 was also exciting for another reason. It was the year that Agatha gave birth to her and Archie's daughter, Rosalind. At this point in our story, we're going to get to the mystery that Agatha's life is still kind of shrouded in to this day. It was 1926, and this was a year that got... I'm sorry, my script just... There we go. 1926 was a year that tragedy hit. In April, Agatha's mother, who she had been extremely close with, I think especially after her father passed away, ended up passing away herself. And Agatha had to leave her small little family behind to go and clean out her childhood home. And as she was doing so, Archie started cheating on her. Yeah. No. Yeah. With a family friend and his golf buddy, Nancy Neal.
Wait. That's one person, not a family friend and a golf buddy.
Yeah. One person. Yes.
Okay, sorry.
So, wow. Yeah. Sad. So one December night, feeling completely overwhelmed, Agatha ended up leaving her home with absolutely no warning. One of my sources did say that she and her husband had fought right before she left and that he actually left first to go and spend the weekend with his lover. No one knew where she was going, where Agatha was going, and she did not return that evening. The next day, her car was found abandoned. And according to one of my sources, a letter addressed to Carlo, who was a close friend of hers and her secretary, this letter was left stating that she was traveling to Yorkshire. Instantly, everyone started searching for Agatha. She was an esteemed novelist at this point, and the search was huge, and speculation was everywhere. I also found a fun piece of information related to, once again, Arthur Conan Doyle. It's all tying together here. A couple of other famous crime authors of the day, including Conan Doyle, were drawn into this search. And I am curious if these other authors felt a sort of kinship with her or personal connection, because they're all kind of in that same writing community, that same genre.
Right.
I'm not really sure. Conan Doyle supposedly took one of Agatha's gloves, presumably found in her car, I would think, to a medium in an attempt to find her.
That tracks.
Of course he did.
You know, he's doing his part.
Right? I thought that was so cool.
He's like, don't worry, I got it.
Yeah, I got this girl. Like, I'm going to find her.
Yep, I'm going to find her.
So eventually, sorry, I keep my screen buttons bouncing around. Eventually, it was deduced that she had managed to reach King's Cross train station, travel to Harrogate by train, and then she checked into a hotel under the pseudonym Teresa Neal. And I find the choice of her faux last name interesting.
Yeah.
I did. The Neal.
It totally made me, huh.
And the husband, that was his other lady. Which I'm not sure what, I didn't find anything super obvious why she chose that name, but just strange. And this hotel that she checked into is now known as the Old Swan Hotel. And when she checked in, she was recognized by members of the hotel's band, which led the search to its close. Also, I just want to shout them out. I did some research here. I looked up on Google Maps where Sunningdale was in relation to Harrogate, and Sunningdale was where Agatha and Archie lived. According to modern transportation, Harrogate is 4 hours north of where Agatha would have started her journey. So this was not a short little jaunt. She really traveled. And I also want to give a little shout out to the Old Swan Hotel here. I looked them up too, just kind of surfing around, and they were one of the sources that I used. And the place looks absolutely beautiful, and they host fun murder mystery nights, which I think is really cool. It seems like they really have leaned into the history behind it, which I love.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah. In total, go ahead.
No, that's okay. That's all I had to say.
Okay. In total, Agatha was missing for a solid 11 days before she was found. When Archie came to pick Agatha up at the hotel after he was alerted by police to her location, she didn't recognize him. It was possible she had a concussion, and it seems she was certainly suffering from amnesia. I found in my sources two doctors did diagnose her officially with amnesia.
What the heck?
Yeah. After this event, Agatha lived in London with her daughter and her friend Carlo, who I mentioned above. And she did go through psychiatric treatment. Her husband did not stay with her at this time, and the two eventually did divorce in 1928.
Ooh, and that's a testy thing for that day and age, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
That's still kind of taboo to do that.
Absolutely. Yes. The exact reason for Agatha's disappearance and what happened during those 11 days she was missing is unknown to this day. Agatha was a very, very private person. She did not talk about these 11 days with anyone. And there are some theories behind her disappearance. What? The first one, yes. The first one was that she suffered a mental health break. She was really, really grieving her mother at this time. And then on top of that, when she's trying to clean out her childhood home, her husband starts cheating on her and having an affair. So I think that's enough. And like I said, she was extremely, extremely close with her mother. I didn't include this in my script because I needed to cut some stuff out, but she traveled with her mom a lot. Like it must have really, really hit her. So that's enough to do just about anyone in, I would say.
Three.
The second theory is that it was a scandal. She was taking revenge on her husband and his infidelity by trying to make it look like Archie had murdered her. And the third theory is that it was a publicity stunt. During the time after she was found, the public didn't seem to favor this theory very much. And I don't see that either, personally.
I don't either. I don't even see the second one very much either, because I'm like, she doesn't strike me as the kind of woman that would be that, I don't know, self-centered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She doesn't strike me like that.
Right. So, exactly.
But
and it even said like she was extremely, extremely private. So why would she be either A, trying to pull a publicity stunt, or either
right.
way, it's kind of a publicity stunt.
If she wanted to smear her husband's name, she was like a well-known author. There was a lot easier ways she could have done that.
Oh, true. Totally. Exactly.
Absolutely.
As far as like the mental health crisis, do you know if like there were marital issues on top of the affair that, like, you know, I mean, the affair and losing her mom could definitely have pushed her into, you know, kind of a crisis mode. But like you mentioned, there might have been arguing earlier. So I also wonder if like the affair was the last straw.
Yeah.
Just got to a breaking point.
Like,
right.
The other subject matters in the argument could have been totally like irrelevant. And then it pushed him to have an affair. And then it was just like, okay, now I'm like, what was happening?
Sure. Or even if there was stuff, like, I don't want to put anything out there, but if they were having marital issues and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, my mom's passed, I'm grieving, I'm having a rough time at home, and now he has an affair. Like, who wouldn't that push into a mental health crisis?
Absolutely.
Right.
I didn't find anything specifically talking about marital problems before the affair, but in my mind, I wouldn't
discount it.
Yeah. I don't think it's out of the range of possibility by any stretch.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Sad.
So sad.
Afterwards, the remainder of Agatha's life remained steeped in travel and writing. Along with works under her own name, she began using a pseudonym, Mary Westmacott, which allowed her to branch out in her writing to other topics outside of mystery and detective novels, which is another weird tie-in with, like, Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
He didn't change his name, but he was thinking about killing Holmes off.
I was just thinking, like, he should have just done a pseudonym, and then he could have his Holmes, and he could have his other friends, too.
His other friends, too. Eventually, she did remarry a gentleman she met in her travels, and his name was Max Mallowen. He was an archaeologist in training. The two traveled constantly, with Agatha continuing her writing, but also helping Max in his archaeological digs.
Oh,
yeah.
They were like really, really Jones couple.
Which is like, yeah. I know. I love this. In 1930, Agatha branched into playwriting, which would become a poignant addition to her career for the rest of her life. During World War II, Agatha and Max were separated as they both did their part for the war effort, but they were thankfully again reunited once more at war's end. And on January 12th, 1976, after a wild life, Agatha passed peacefully away.
Aww. I got chills.
So
I'm really glad that in the end she had her happiness and that she had like that peaceful passing. Like that is like good. Yay.
Yeah.
That.
Right. It yes. wasn't just, it sounded to me like she didn't let that stint, well, I don't want to say it like that because I'm not trying to, she was able to really overcome the challenges that she faced in those 11 days and before.
Right.
You know, whatever. And you know what? Even just overcoming childhood challenges, like having your father die at 11 years old, I can't imagine. That's awful. I can't imagine.
She's definitely got a history of some serious tragedy.
Like, yeah.
You know?
And I think in my research, if I remember correctly, she was actually homeschooled. So she was even closer with her parents. Like they were, don't quote me for gospel in that, but I think that's what one of the things I remember and I had to take out because I was going crazy. I was going to take over the whole episode and I didn't think you guys wanted that. So
no worries. Oh, I love it though. That was, oh, I really like that. That she is definitely a fascinating person. And now I'm intrigued enough that I'm like, okay, I want to know more about her. Like, I want to go into more things with her and, like, read more of her things and all of that kind of stuff. Like, I'm like, wow.
Have you, yeah. Have you ever read any of her novels? Okay.
No, I really didn't know anything really about her until you started talking about her.
I recommend And Then There Were None. That's a good one. I haven't read a lot by her. That's actually the only one I've read, but it was very good.
Right on.
So there's my recommendation.
I love it. Cool. Yay. All right. So are we ready to get into Elizabeth Baffert?
Yes.
Okay. So before we get into the absolute nightmare that is Elizabeth's story, let me set the scene for you. So picture this. It is 1560, like a million ass years ago, in Hungary. And it's in a mess of like political chaos at this time. And into this world is born a beautiful little girl who will become, allegedly, one of history's most prolific female serial killers. And we're talking potentially hundreds of victims with her, like hundreds, which is just insane. Now, at the same time, I know for a few people that are out there, sometimes you very well could be thinking right now, like, oh, great, here we go. Another blood countless who's like obsessed with like bathing in virgin blood to stay young forever and, you know, the whole nine yards, right? And yeah, we'll definitely get, like, I'm going to go into that, like, to that whole mess. But here's the thing that makes the case absolutely fascinating and also equally terrifying. We genuinely do not know how much of this shit actually happened versus how much was political propaganda for the time, right, and designed to, you know, steal away her massive fortune and all the things. So I got to ask you guys right off the bat, what do you guys think? Like, do you guys think she was a genuine monster or a victim of medieval smear campaign kind of a thing? Like, what do you guys think and what you know about her, or of her, if you've heard of her?
Here we go again. I have to mention it every episode. There was an episode of Morbid, the true crime podcast, where they covered Elizabeth Bathory. And
I have not heard that episode yet. Oh my gosh, yeah, I'm going to have to go back and listen to it like today.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I can't remember what episode it was. It was a while back. But I don't remember it because it was so long, but I'm tempted to say a little bit of both. I don't think necessarily she was a great person, but I also don't think the propaganda of the time helped her any either, we'll put it that way.
Absolutely. What do you
think? I go more on the side of it was mostly propaganda personally.
Okay.
I like, if even some of the things were true, then yes, not a great person. But you're talking about Morbid. I'm going to talk about Lore. That's not usually the podcast I say after I say that.
That's true.
But I'm pretty sure it's been covered on Lore. There might have even been a time suck, to be honest.
Okay.
But I think that when women are in power, and especially in like a very male dominated system.
Oh yeah, and that time, woo, we think we got it rough. Now they had it way rough.
Yeah. Back then. So I do think, you know, I would say more than half. You know, if I was gonna say like, you know, 100%, I believe 100%, I don't. Like, I would say I'm at like 60-70%, where a lot of it was a smear campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now she also, I hate saying absolutes. This was a woman who came from very high standing, so I wonder how much of normal constraints might not apply to me because I can get away with things until I can't.
Mm.
That's my dog. Sorry.
But
beat stretch.
I have a very sound asleep kitty at the moment over in the chair.
Yeah. So that's my very convoluted answer was like, I am more on the side of a lot of this was probably a smear campaign because you have this woman in power who has money and, you know, the men want the power and the money and the property, probably, to be honest.
Yeah.
And just depending on how she was raised, it could also be that, okay, I can do these things because I am at a higher standard than someone else.
Totally. Totally. All right. So let's start with baby Elizabeth, okay? Born into the Bathory family. And these people were loaded. Like, she was born into a very wealthy family. And we're talking about one of the most powerful, noble families in Hungary for its time. And her uncle was literally the king of Poland. This family had more money and power than they knew what to do with. So Elizabeth gets married off at a very young age, in my opinion. She was married at 15. To this.
Yeah.
What?
I said, yeah.
Yeah. To this military dude. And I'm not sure if I'm going to say it right. Ferenc Nadasty, if I'm saying that right. Nadasty. And this guy earned himself the charming nickname, the Black Knight of Hungary.
Oh.
Real romantic.
It's a flesh wound.
Right? Real romantic. The wedding present that they got? A fucking castle. Like, honestly, like, oh, you guys got married. We love you so much. Here you go. Enjoy this, like, massive 22,000 square foot castle. Have fun.
Amazing. Amazing. Rocks.
Right? And P.S., it wasn't actually 22,000 square feet. I just made that up. But this place is going to become really, really important to the story, though, because it's basically ground zero for all the horror that is about to unfold.
Yeah.
So now, here's where things always get so interesting to me. Ferenc is off fighting in this massive castle with way too much time. Or I'm sorry, excuse me, leaving Elizabeth alone with way too much time on her hands and absolute power over hundreds of servants and peasants. And guys, absolute power in medieval times, that's a recipe for some seriously dark shit, in my opinion. Yeah. Like, not a good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, do you think, because, I don't know, there's a part of me on this part that I'm like, okay, if I was isolated and left with a castle, I would probably become the laziest bitch ever. I'd be like, fetch my grapes. You know what I mean? I wouldn't do anything. But at the same time, I could totally see how, like, okay, I have a castle. I am technically like a descendant of royalty. And now my husband's gone and I can just do whatever the F I want. Like,
yeah.
So I could totally see it corrupting on that scale. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you think isolation would be like a good thing, or do you think it would corrupt?
I mean, honestly, I feel like it almost could go either way. I'm thinking, I know this is a weird place for my brain to go to. in, so where my brain first goes is World War II, where many, many, many men were not home. They were not here to be doing jobs, to be running the factories, to be, because they were overseas doing what they felt was their patriotic duty. Right. And a lot of the women in this country were able to kind of get some of that power. Yeah. And they realized, there is no reason I can't go work in a factory. There is no reason I can't go work in a rail yard. There's no reason, even though, like, the WASPs, they went out and flew planes, like, for the military.
So calling for women, like,
yep. Oh, well, in World War One, that was another one. World War Two was the baseball league. World War One, women started doing this as well. Going back a little bit, but so I think in some ways it could have gone in a way of like, all right, I'm here, I'm gonna get stuff done, and I'm gonna do stuff my way, and it could have gone really well. But there is also historic proof that power does corrupt, and being alone in a huge castle and bored and with all that power, it could go other direction.
Yeah, it really could. It could really go south. I agree with you. What about you, Grace?
I would say it depends on the person, right? Because on a situation, like, we know from studies that isolation does really nasty things to a brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also, okay, let's say the World War II and one example, the women were doing the things that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like they could just really sit idly and let the country keep running.
True. Right.
And they weren't necessarily alone, as opposed to you are a very wealthy young lady who is being waited on hand and foot in a castle. You're probably not going to have the same kinds of responses as someone who is like, crap, like, I need to do these things, or like, you know,
I have to keep food on the table.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
my
I have
children.
To keep food on the table. I have to, you know, those rivets aren't going to rivet themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
As opposed to someone who is like being served, basically.
That's very true.
Like, you know, and if she's not, some of the women you were talking about earlier, Christiana, might have been with equals. Most of the people she's with is she's going to be kind of trained from a young age that they're beneath her.
Oh, yeah.
That's just my psychology two cents there.
I know. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Love the way you think. All right. So the first red flags start showing up pretty early. Servants begin disappearing, and not like, oh, Maria quit and moved to the next village disappearing. You know, like, we're talking like full on vanishing without a trace. Like, local villages start whispering about screams coming from the castle at night. But here's the thing. In the 1600s Hungary, if you were nobility, you could pretty much do whatever the hell you wanted to peasants, which that's disturbing. And the legal system was basically, nobles can't be touched. So even if people suspected something, who were they going to call? They didn't have ghostbusters back then. So,
yeah.
So her husband then dies in 1604. And that's when shit gets really dark. Uh-oh. So Elizabeth is now a widow with the complete control over massive estates, no husband to answer to, and the alleged killings start really ramping up, like, significantly. So I really wonder too, like, with this, like, if I back it up, like, were her husband's death like a trigger for all of this? Like, could it have set her off?
Do we know how he died? Like,
oh, that is something I don't have. I don't know how he died. Like, that would be something I should look up.
Like, my brain is going somewhere very dark with this. It was like, do we know that, like, he wasn't gotten out of the way so she could have all of the,
oh,
all the money? Like, did they have any kids?
Oh, that's, as far as I know, no.
Never mind. I was going to say something, and I'm like, never mind. It's like, probably not a bad thing. But,
No, I didn't think about that, but my brain kind of went to an equally dark place as well of, like, when he was home and not off, because you said he was a military man, when he was not off fighting, I wonder, even if she was doing some dark stuff, he was it keeping her in line almost in a way when he could. And then when he wasn't there, and I hate to think about like what that means, keeping her in line, because that probably was not pretty.
He was probably the only one that had actual power over her, though, too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even if she was from this very high family, she at that time, women were still subservient to their husbands. There we go.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Scary thoughts. Sorry.
Totally scary thoughts. I agree. And it is. It's going to get so much darker here. So what exactly was Elizabeth supposedly doing, right? So according to the testimonies, and we'll get to how reliable those are in a minute, she was torturing young women in absolutely medieval ways. We're talking about beatings, burnings, freezing servants naked in courtyards during winter, and some truly creative torture methods that I won't go into detail about, because honestly, even for this show, it's a little too much.
Gut churning.
We can leave it at that and your imagination can run wild with it. But here's the famous part that like practically everyone knows when it comes to her is about the blood baths, right? Like we all know she soaked herself in blood and all that good stuff. Not really good stuff, but you get my point.
Yeah.
The story goes that Elizabeth believed bathing in the blood of young virgins would keep her looking young forever. She supposedly had servants drained of their blood so she could literally bathe in it. Okay, but there's a plot twist. This bloodbath story, it probably actually never happened, which most historians think this detail was added later to make the story even more sensationalized.
Yeah.
It's not in any of like the original trial documents, which honestly, if I could put my two cents on this one, I was a little bit disappointed when I found that out, and not to be like a weirdo or anything like that, but because I was taught initially that Elizabeth Bathory was kind of like our first female vampire, which,
sure,
you know, we meaning you guys and I, we kind of already have a history of like Let It Be a Vampire theory. So I feel like, you know, this need, like, I was so bummed. I'm like, oh man, she really wasn't, like, dang it. Right. But damn if this isn't like part, like this part two, I think is what everyone remembers, right? Like, do you remember that too? Like, that's like the basis of it all.
Yeah.
So by 1610, things are getting out of hand. We're talking about bodies that are starting to pile up, and Elizabeth is getting sloppy with her methods. So the big mistake, she starts targeting daughters of minor nobility instead of just peasants. That's when the people in power actually were like, started to give a shit. Like, oh, now you're going to come after us? Like, oh, okay, now we care. You know, like that kind of situation.
We don't care about the fact that you're murdering other people as long as they're not of any status. Like, oh, okay. That's cool. Right? That's sick.
They're not. Totally. So King Matthias II orders an investigation led by Elizabeth's own cousin. Talk about family drama. And so they said, I take that back. They actually end up raiding the castle. So cousin and her people. And what they allegedly find is straight out of a horror movie. According to testimonies, there were tortured girls still alive in the dungeons, which, bodies in various stages of decomposition and evidence of systematic torture. So Elizabeth's accomplices get arrested and tortured for their confessions. Because that's how justice, of course, worked back then. Yeah. And they name Elizabeth as the masterminds. the testimonies claim she killed anywhere. Oh my gosh, get ready for this. This is wild because I didn't know this part either. She killed anywhere from 60, and this is a big jump, upwards to 650 people.
Whoa, that's a big jump. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big jump. And so that higher number, in my opinion, is almost certainly bullshit. I think.
Yeah, I think.
But
yeah,
if the like lower estimate, if it's the lower estimate we're talking about, a serial killer that puts most modern ones to shame, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me see here. I just kind of missed my place here in my notes. Give me 1 second. So it's really interesting to me because it makes me wonder, like, the trial process of this and all these, like, terrible, torture things to get them to confess. Like, there's some really weird stuff out there. Like, I don't know if you guys have looked into any of that stuff at all in history, like, about some of the ways.
Yeah.
But do you guys remember the Mythbusters episode where they did, like, the water droplet on the head?
I don't remember that episode, but
and I'm like,
yeah, they,
and I always like link things like that. I'm like, I wonder if that was ever used. Like, was that a method of torture that they used at that time? Like, because there's no, I don't know if there's any real documentation on that, on how they did that. But anyway, so now here's where the story gets legally weird. Elizabeth never actually gets a trial. Instead, she gets walled up alive in her own castle. They literally they literally brick up her windows and doors, leaving just a small slot for food. She lives like this for 4 years until she dies in 1614.
Oh God.
So why no trial? Right? Like, why didn't she get a trial?
Yeah.
Well, here's the conspiracy theory part that makes this whole case so fascinating. Elizabeth owned the crown of like a mass, like owned the crown of massive amount of money. We're talking about loans that could bankrupt kingdoms. If she's executed as a serial killer, that debt disappears. If she's just imprisoned, then the crown still owes her estate money. Does that make sense? Right? So, do you think that this was justice or just medieval level financial planning? Like, what do you guys think?
I think there's a lot about the whole trial that's sketchy AF.
Yeah.
Right. Because knowing the financial piece really kind of can shift motives a little bit. And, you know, I think in general, it's pretty well understood at this point that any confessions made out of torture generally aren't true.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that, I mean, 1600s, but like,
right. 1600s. That, like, what are you going to do?
It does like set off like the sketchy radar in my head.
It does. Me, agreed. Agreed. Okay.
I was going to say, like, sorry, the 600 number, like 600 people she potentially killed, that instantly when with like torture, trying to get people to admit, who did this, how many did it happen, that reminds me that was just people desperately spitting out numbers trying to stop the pain.
Yes.
And I don't like the fact that she never actually officially got a trial. So when, or I do have a question though, you said in the trial documentation, was it more a trial looking into this case in general, but they never tried her?
Yep. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I don't love that because they needed to have definitive proof or what could be considered definitive proof of the 1600s, because if it wasn't her, not only was an innocent woman essentially murdered, because I doubt that, even though she wasn't directly killed, like, I doubt being walled up in a room did anything for her lifespan. Not only was she essentially tortured to death, but the person that committed whatever murders did happen was still out there,
right,
and able to do it again.
Totally. Okay,
I have a question, if that's okay.
True infomercial. Yeah. Okay, there's more.
There's more. Okay.
Because Elizabeth Bathory's story doesn't end with her death. Oh no, no, no.
Okay.
This is where things get really creepy for those of us who believe in the paranormal. So the castle is supposedly one of the most haunted places in Europe. People report seeing a woman in white wandering the ruins. Allegedly, it's Elizabeth's spirit still trapped where she died. Locals claim to hear screaming at night. And even though the castle has been, it's been a ruin now for like centuries. The visitors to the castle report feeling overwhelming dread, sudden temperature drops, and some people have reported being physically pushed or scratched by invisible forces. There are also accounts of people taking photos and finding mysterious figures in the background that weren't visible when the picture was taken. Now, me personally, I'm like, okay, I need to go find those pictures. I want to find those pictures. I want to see them for myself. Because
yes,
nowadays, too, like, things are... It's always disappointing. Like, I found out not too long ago. Do you know the infamous photo of the Myrtles plantation with Chloe? Yeah. And finding out that was debunked, I was like, damn it.
I
was like,
I know, right?
Yeah. You know? So the really creepy part, some paranormal investigators claim that the hauntings are not just Elizabeth. They believe the spirits of her victims are also trapped there. And they still experience, are like still experiencing the trauma of their deaths. So motion sensors go off in the empty rooms, because this is of course now like a tourist attraction kind of a thing, and recording equipment will pick up voices in old Hungarian dialects. And multiple people have reported seeing groups of young women in servant clothing appearing and disappearing. Hmm. Now, one investigator claimed to have recorded what sounded like a woman's voice saying, "Help!" to, like, in multiple languages, including some that weren't spoken in that region during Elizabeth's time. So that's really interesting to me. And that was, that was kind of... if I remember correctly, I got to look back at my resource notes, which I'll have for the episode, but I'm pretty sure I found that one on YouTube. So that was a YouTube deep dive. But here's what really gets to me about the whole case, is that we are probably never going to know the truth, which really kind of bumps me out a little bit, because it's like, was Elizabeth Bathory a genuine monster who tortured and killed hundreds of young women? Or was she a powerful woman who got in the way of political and financial interests and became the victim of history's most successful, like, character assassination, so to speak?
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
I really wonder about that. Like, I mean, what do you guys think really happened here?
What did her cousin have to gain for the investigation?
Ooh.
Oh, that's a good question.
Like, I'm not like going after his or her character. I'm just curious of, like, because if she didn't have kids, didn't have siblings, who would all of that wealth go to?
Right. Like,
were they feuding, or like, that's another, my,
that's
like, if he had,
too.
He or she had beef with Elizabeth. Huh.
Ooh. Dun, dun, dun.
Was it definitely that we can tell known that bodies were found?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So clearly something happened. Like, the actual murders, the number of murders themselves might be unknown.
Right.
Or deaths, I should say. But something clearly happened.
Yeah.
And
we don't want to overlook that, obviously, too, because if people were brutally murdered, that is... We don't want to just gloss over that either, I don't think.
Yeah.
Right, because there were people who were still being, like, tied up and tortured to still having bodies that were like in the process of decomposing.
Yeah.
So like
I want to know too. Right. I want to know too, like, this is like my forensics brain going here. Like, what were the injuries found? I mean, I know there was allegedly like burning, freezing. I'm not going to go too far into it, but
right.
Cause my other thought was, did that, maybe this is far fetched, but did something happen where the servants were starting, like, did some kind of illness happen that swept through that? And Elizabeth might have been kept away from it because of her status, but a bunch of people died. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that that maybe is far-fetched in me trying to just
sure
be nice.
But that's like, I love that theory. Like, seriously, I really
like
do.
Even the common cold at that time could kill
take
someone
you out, right?
Even if it wasn't like a plague or anything, like any kind of illness like that could spread like freaking wildfire,
right?
I need more forensics knowledge here.
I know. Like, I need more of that too. And like, you know, there's another part of me that's like, if I'm thinking back to this, like, was she framed? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, was she framed? Because
that I thought of that. I'm sorry, Brie. What were you going to say?
I'll say we did just talk about the Dawn's Macabre like a week ago. So that's probably why you're thinking about plague.
True. True.
But like,
yeah,
like, could she have been? Because you think about it too, like, okay, so this is back in like the 1600s. This is also like a little bit before the whole like Salem witch trials too. But at that time, the frame of mind, I mean, you could literally have a dream about someone mm-hmm. doing something ill and being like, oh, they did it. And they took it verbatim. And like, oh, okay, well, mm-hmm. you know, let's burn them at the stake. You know, like it was
yeah,
it was that much of a snap judgment with no evidence whatsoever. So
I mean that. Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. Go for it. We're all here
that,
for it.
that's fair. That's a fair. Like I like that. I mean, I don't like the idea of that, but like I like where your thoughts coming from, Star. How do I say that without it sounding weird? Because I mean, witch trials were going on in Europe from like I don't know. I mean, we talked about the Malleus Maleficarum one of our episodes ago. Uh-huh. And I mean, there were witch trials in the 1500s. There were mm-hmm. witch trials in the 1600s in Europe. So
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there was like there's a famous werewolf trial in like the 1500s, weren't there?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Even if she, you know, say someone did get sick or she found someone dead somehow, whether they were murdered by another person and left there or they died naturally or whatever, if she was found near that person, because and thinking like I think I kind of went into this with Dan's Macabre too, was if she was a pretty high status person, I'm wondering how much she knew about like a body in decomposition.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even if it wasn't like in decomp, like if she found someone that had some kind of was passed away, that had some kind of horrific injury, and she her instinct was to go, oh, my God, and to like drop down and be like, are you OK? Are you OK? Like, what happened here? If someone found that,
she could look guilty. Yeah, yep. Totally. So I think there's a little bit of this, too, where I feel like the truth very well could probably lie somewhere in the middle. You know what I mean? Like, did Elizabeth abuse her power and harm people? Maybe. Did she bathe in the blood and kill 600 people? Probably not.
Probably not.
But the legend has become so much bigger than the person that it almost doesn't matter what the truth is anymore. You know what I mean? Like, however, I don't know. I'm undecided about that. Like, yeah. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. But what we do know is that the castle remains a place where people report experiencing something genuinely terrifying. Now, whether that's actually the ghost of Elizabeth Bathory, the spirits, you know, whether it's the her victims or just honestly psychic weight of centuries of dark legends, you know, it's hard to say. But one thing's for sure, I am super grateful to both of you for being on the show and for sharing your stories as well, because I loved the connection between the two authors as well, and definitely all of their spooky shit. So,
yeah.
So pretty much, I mean, that's pretty much it, you guys, as far as this story is concerned. So this is the bloody, murky, absolutely wild story of Elizabeth Bathory. So was she history's most prolific female killer or the victim of a medieval frame job? The answer might be buried with her in the castle that is now standing in Slovakia. So,
oh,
yeah, right? Yep, that's where it is. So it's in Slovakia. So
was,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. So she was Hungarian.
Yep.
Were the borders of Hungary redrawn, and that's why it's in Slovakia now?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Just clarifying.
Yeah. Those Slavic countries, right? It's like that. My ancestors are from them, so I feel like I can say that.
My cult leader's from
there. They're like, it seems like they're constantly getting like kind of a lot of redrawing there a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah. For yeah. Sure. Yeah. All right, you guys. So I want to give you an opportunity here. I would love for the audience to kind of know where they can find you and hang out with you more if they love this episode. So please go ahead and plug your info.
Cool. I'll let you do this because you're so good at it.
Okay. So guys, you can find Something Strange on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, and we are on YouTube. We put our episodes up on there. You can check out our socials. We're on Facebook and Instagram.
And TikTok.
Oh, and TikTok. Yes. And you can, we would love to hear from you guys. Shout at us. Leave us a comment either on our episodes or on our Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, wherever. You can also send us a Gmail at somethingstrangepod24@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. Let us, and go check Star out too at Creepy Shit Podcast, because she is amazing.
All right. So don't forget to subscribe. Leave us a review if you love this episode. And if you want to hang out with me more, you can, of course, follow me over at Creepy Shit Podcast on Instagram. It's creepy_shit_podcast. And yes, I have joined the TikTok realm as well. So you can follow me over there too at Creepy Host Star. So next time, if you're ever in Slovakia or you're traveling throughout Europe, you know, you maybe just want to skip that particular castle tour or not. I don't know if you're feeling brave, whatever. But some places are better left undisturbed. I'm all tongue-tied now. Sorry. But last but not least, never forget, sometimes the creepiest shit is also the truest. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.